On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Donald Trump is probably the most significant thing to happen to the religious right in a few decades.
OMG, this guy is actually a bigot.
If she becomes president, no one since Richard Nixon would have been on the national stage that long and won the White House.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
You know, in this day and age, you now have teleprompters. In this day and age, you have people who write the speeches and go over them three or four times and make sure all the phrases are what they are supposed to be. In 1972, you made the speeches the way preachers preached in 72. You made the speeches from the heart. You made the speeches from your own knowledge. You made the speech that you thought would really work. And in many cases, you made the speech as you were making it.
Former Speaker of the California Assembly and former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown, in an interview a few years ago, Brown is now 82 years old. He hasn't held office for a dozen years, but he is still a power player in California politics. His protege, Kamala Harris, is the front runner to succeed Senator Barbara Boxer. Voters will cast ballots in tomorrow's primary, and Harris is expected to face off against the second place candidate in November. 33 people are running for that slot, and one of them played the geography card over the weekend. On Saturday, Orange County Congresswoman Loretta Sanchez told prospective voters in Whittier that Harris is a San Franciscan. Then she said, quote, "They control everything, so we're trying to beat them." Here to discuss where California's power base resides and how it could change is Bill Whalen. He's a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. He also worked as a consultant for California politicians, including former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and former L.A. Mayor Richard Riordan. Welcome to the program.
Great to be with you.
Well, so is she right? I mean, look at who our top three most powerful positions are. They are all from the Bay Area. We've got Boxer, Dianne Feinstein, Governor Jerry Brown. So is she right to say that the Bay Area dominates?
Well, the answer is yes and no. She's right in terms of how she is defining this particular instance. You notice, for example, she can't play the gender card because for the past 25 years we've had two women senators, but she can play the geography card because both Dianne Feinstein and Barbara Boxer are products of Bay Area politics. But this is a question of how you want to cut California into pieces. For example, you look at the statewide constitutional offices. There are eight of them. Six are controlled by Northern Californians. Two are by Southern Californians, as John Chang, the treasurer, and Alex Padilla. But another way to slice this would be your state legislature. You mentioned Willie Brown in the intro. The last eight assembly speakers holding the same job as Willie Brown, this is going back to 1998, term limits has flipped these jobs pretty fast, but the last eight speakers all had Los Angeles connections, all from districts in the LA area. So by that definition, Southern California does pretty well in Sacramento.
Oh, interesting. Still, the top slot, governor, aside from Schwarzenegger, it hasn't gone to a Southern Californian in a while.
Well, but again, let's slice this a different way. Let's go back to 50 years and Ronald Reagan first winning the job in 1966. Over the last 50 years, Southern California Republicans and Democrats, that includes Gray Davis, have held the office for 36 of those 50 years, so not a bad representation. But this is about Loretta Sanchez having to push two very big buttons in order to defeat Kamala Harris in November, assuming they're the top two finishers in Tuesday's vote. One button she is obviously going to push is race. She would be the first Latina senator representing California, so she will talk to Latina voters, and she gets a huge break if Donald Trump is indeed the Republican nominee. But the second button she's going to have to push is geography. Why? Because of the question of Southern California representation, but also because of math. If she's going to defeat Kamala Harris, she has to overcome Harris's advantage in the Bay Area by doing very well in voter-rich Los Angeles County and Orange County. So that's why you play the geography card.
Interesting. And when it comes to voter turnout, though, is she at a disadvantage when you look at perhaps her base of support among Latinos and their voter turnout isn't as high as other groups?
Exactly. So she has to hope for a large turnout. But again, here is where Trump probably does her an enormous, enormous benefit, because he is obviously bringing new voters on board, many of them Latinos and Latinas. But the other thing she's going to have to do is she's going to have to pivot and reach out to independent voters and also reach out to disgruntled Republicans who want to have a horse in the race. And so they may be more apt to vote for her than Kamala Harris. So it'd be very interesting to watch the various strategies she plays: geography, race, but also ideology and the various striations of the California electorate.
Interesting. Well, when you're talking about the Latino voter bloc, is that also part of the Northern California split? Are there more Latino voters in Southern California?
Way more in Southern California. It's really all about Los Angeles County. And, you know, look, Los Angeles County is where elections are made or broken in California. If you cannot carry L.A. County as a Democrat, you're in big, big trouble. Obviously, you probably lose. If you're Republican, if you can't compete there, you don't have a snowball's chance as well. So I suspect that as that race moves to October and November, if indeed it is a Harris-Sanchez race, you're going to see the both of them really hunkering down in L.A. County.
Now, what about Antonio Villaraigosa, the former L.A. mayor? I understand he wanted to run for Senate, but was told by Willie Brown, no, it's not your turn.
Well, this is where the Northern California mob, if you will, the power structure kind of rankles people. Told by Willie Brown it wasn't his turn. Also, keep in mind that the Senate race was done kind of neatly when Kamala Harris and Gavin Newsom, lieutenant governor, also a Bay Area product, sat down and kind of came to a power sharing arrangement, if you will. They share the same political consultant, so it wasn't very hard. And Newsom backed off the Senate race and is now running for governor. And that 2018 governor's race and possibly the 2018 Senate race, if Dianne Feinstein steps down, is fascinating, because you're going to see the same geographic divide. Newsom's already running for governor. He's a Bay Area guy, former mayor of San Francisco. John Chang, the current state treasurer, he's a Los Angeles guy. He's thrown his hat in. Villaraigosa is sniffing around. He may run for governor. He may run for Senate. Alex Padilla, the Secretary of State, also a Los Angeles product. He may throw his hat in the ring, as may Tom Steyer, the very wealthy hedge fund billionaire from Northern California. So again, you're going to see not just Democrat versus Democrat, but North versus South.
And what about Eric Garcetti?
Well, Eric Garcetti sits out there, and he's interesting because, again, possibly a big block of voters in Los Angeles. But keep in mind, being a mayor of Los Angeles is a distinctly mixed blessing when it comes to running for statewide office. Richard Reardon, who's a friend of mine who I know, he ran for governor in 2002, could not get out of the primaries. Tom Bradley famously lost twice running for governor. Sam Yorty, the former Los Angeles mayor, ran and lost. I suspect it's for the same reason why sports teams like to chant "Beat L.A." in arenas, and that there's just something about being the mayor of Los Angeles that makes you Goliath and kind of a bad guy wrestler in a race. And so Garcetti, to win statewide, he's going to have to, I think, kind of overcome people's preconceived notions about L.A.
All right. So what about the issues between Northern and Southern California? Is there a rivalry over money, over water policy? What?
Yeah, the three things would be, number one, where the money goes for, let's say, education. How do L.A. schools do versus Northern California schools? The second would be the issue of road repairs, which, in, of course, driver crazy Southern California, is not an inconsequential matter. But then the third one, the big daddy of them, would be water allocation. And you see this playing out right now in the state capitol with Governor Brown and his water tunnel plan. And Northern Californians are crying foul. There are environmentalists who say there's too much water going south. Southern Californians would probably say we don't get enough water, can't get enough water. So, again, this is an issue that divides the state. And keep in mind, we historically have always talked about a north-south division there. There is the proposal to cut California into six pieces, the initiative that Tim Draper has floated, the Six Californians Initiative. But before that, people saw this as a very simple way to divide the state, which is just kind of cut it in half, dividing north and south.
Okay. Bill Whalen, research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
Special interest groups have spent a record $28 million and counting on legislative races ahead of tomorrow's primary. About $10 million of those dollars have come from charter school groups. The bulk of that money coming from a few big donors who want to see more school reform and a political environment that's friendlier to charter schools. Jim Miller is a reporter at the Sacramento Bee. Welcome to the program.
Sure thing. Thanks for having me.
Okay, great to have you. So how does the amount of money being given by charter school groups compare to the money, let's say, being spent by other special interests like oil and gas or developers?
It is quite a bit more. If you look at the, you know, what's been spent through Sunday, just like you were saying, it's pushing $10 million. If you look at the three of the other independent expenditure committees that have received significant funding from oil and energy interests, it's about three times the spending by those committees. So it's definitely noteworthy, and it's quite a bit more than they've spent in the last few cycles.
Right, and they're not spending on school board races. They're spending on legislative races, Assembly
well,
and Senate.
Well, they are also spending on local races. But they definitely are paying some significant attention to these legislative primaries this year.
So what is it? What do these groups want from Sacramento?
Well, lots of issues happen in both the California legislature and then also the State Board of Education that deal with school governance, that deal with teacher evaluation, curriculum, and in the legislature, which is what these people are running for. There are bills every year, and as well as the state budget, the biggest bill of all, that have to do with things like teacher tenure or performance evaluations or funding the charter schools. And another influential education group called EdVoice care a great deal about. Also, the California Teachers Association, which is the largest teacher union in the state, also is active in these issues in the California legislature.
But they haven't spent as much in this campaign so far.
They have not. And if you look at what they spent a couple years ago, they spent a significant amount. Part of that was related to the primary for the superintendent of public instruction race at the time. But they also spent heavily in some legislative districts. And when I talked to representatives of the CTA, they said they were keeping an eye on things. They were doing what they planned to do. But the context to it as well is that the CTA and some other groups and unions are very supportive of extending temporary income taxes in November. Those signatures were collected earlier this year. They are in for verification. And if that qualifies for the ballot, CTA will have to spend millions as part of that campaign.
Right. And so are they saving their money for the November election?
I think so. And they will, if they see a legislative race that causes them some concern, I expect that they would spend in that. That's what their spokesperson said, that they would take a look at the candidates who come out of the primary tomorrow and then base their campaign decisions upon that.
Let's talk about one race that's getting a lot of money, a lot of outside money being poured into it. It's a local race here in District 43. That's the Glendale-Burbank area. This is Mike Gatto's seat. He's being termed out. The two leading candidates to replace him, both Democrats. One is Glendale Councilwoman Laura Friedman, and the other one is City Clerk Artie Kasakian. And he says that she has taken a lot of outside money. But you, I believe, spoke with one of her advisors, and he said she didn't know why these groups were supporting her.
Correct. I mean, these are, they're independent expenditures, so there is not supposed to be any communication between the candidate and the groups making the expenditure. But, right, that's what her campaign said, is that, the first they knew of, in this case, the support of the Parent Teacher Alliance, which is sponsored by the California Charter School Association, was when the mail and the radio ads and signs and whatnot began showing up. And I heard that from a few other folks that I checked in with around the state, is that they were kind of surprised at the volume of money being spent on their behalf or their clients' behalf.
Well, I guess that's good when it comes to not coordinating with the campaign, which they're not supposed to do. But Laura Friedman hasn't given any indication that she's pro-charter schools?
Yeah. In speaking with her campaign, he said when they began hearing complaints from people who would receive the mail and see who was paying for it, they said, "What's up? What's up with this?" And they said, "Well, come on in and look at the questionnaires that Ms. Friedman filled out for the Charter Schools Association, for the CTA. According to him, the questionnaires were pretty neutral, gave no real indication that flagged her as a strong charter school supporter or otherwise. And so the volume of money being spent there, I mean, I think it's north of $1.4 million now by the Parent Teacher Alliance. I mean, that's a lot of money to spend in a race where someone apparently isn't a real public supporter of your positions.
Well, maybe it's because her opponent has accepted the endorsement of teachers union.
Could be, yeah.
So where is this money coming from? Because in the past, groups, Michael Bloomberg, for example, former mayor of New York, has donated to the charter cause, a foundation associated with the Waltons of Walmart fame have been associated with money being spent in California races. Are they also involved this time around?
They are. They are. If you look at these committees and then look at who's given the money in the last year or so, it's a pretty small universe of people, all very wealthy. Charter School Association, you know, a couple of their big donors is the CEO of Netflix, Reed Hastings, Eli Broad, and Carrie Walton Penner, who is the granddaughter of the Walmart founder, Sam Walton. And then if you look at EdVoice, their independent spending committee, quite a bit of the money comes from Bill Bloomfield, a Southern California businessman, venture capitalist Arthur Rock, and some others. So it's not a big universe of people who have provided the bulk of the money for these committees and who are spending in these legislative primaries.
Well, thanks so much for joining us.
Great. Thank you.
That's Jim Miller. He's a reporter for the Sacramento Bee and the Capital Alert blog. And we'd like to hear from you. Are you concerned about all these independent expenditures by outside groups? And do you think they'll have an effect on tomorrow's election results? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can reach out on Twitter or Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Stanford, Baylor University, college athletes have been in the news for rape. Are male athletes more likely to sexually assault women? A new study has some answers. We'll have that next on Press Play.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune Download podcast. To receive a free song of the day, find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Campus rape is in the news again. Former Stanford swimmer Brock Turner was convicted last week of sexual assault. He raped an unconscious woman behind a dumpster on Stanford's campus. And outrage erupted when he was sentenced to just 6 months behind bars for that rape. At Baylor University, an investigation last month found that the athletic department ignored a series of allegations of sexual assault. And in a lawsuit against another school, the University of Tennessee, women say the school accepts a culture of sexual violence, which has allowed athletes there to get away with sexual assault. Athletes and sexual assault. Christy McCray has been studying this as an assistant professor of health and sports sciences at Otterbein University in Ohio. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thank you. Well, there is a new study out this month that has found a strong link between athletes and sexual assault. And I know you weren't involved with that particular study, but you're aware of it. Can you give us a summary?
Yeah, sure. So this study looked at surveying intercollegiate athletes, recreational athletes, and non-athletes. And they measured them on a variety of different scales, looking at their attitudes toward accepting rape myths, their attitudes towards women. And then one key piece of it, which is getting the headlines, is around sexual coercion and whether or not athletes are more likely to engage in sexually coercive behaviors than non-athletes.
And what have they found?
They did find that there is the intercollegiate athletes and the recreational athletes actually had similar findings, which was new information. Nobody's ever looked at recreational athletes before. And they did find that kind of across the board, about 54% of athletes, including those rec athletes, and about 38% of the non-athletes had reported some sort of sexually coercive behavior.
That's a broad definition, though, some sort of sexually coercive behavior. What does that mean in fact?
Yeah, it is really broad. Some of the questions that they asked them were things like, I made my partner have sex without a condom, no force. Some of them did indicate forceful behavior, which also leads, or we would consider that to be sexual assault. But when we think about sexual coercion, we think about placing pressure on someone versus when we think about sexual assault, we think of actual force threat, intimidation, right? It's like a little bit of a step farther. And so sexual coercion is on the lower end, if you were, so to speak, of sexual assault.
So a study from a while ago, 1995, found that while athletes only represented 3% of college students, they accounted for 19% of sexual assaults. And so what does that tell you? Why does it appear to be, at least from that study, that there are more sexual assaults among athletes?
So what's interesting about that study, and there were actually quite a few in the 1990s that tried to answer this kind of this age-old question of, are athletes more violent or more likely to perpetrate sexual assault? And all of the studies have been done differently. They've all used different methodologies, different survey methods. And so I hesitate to say that athletes are more likely to perpetrate sexual crimes, because we know that there are lots of athletes who don't do that, as opposed to looking at the institution of athletics and the way that athletics culture sets up a place as a breeding ground, if that makes sense.
Right. So what is it about that culture?
So some of it is, when we think of the term rape culture, which was actually founded in anthropology, rape cultures are characterized by high levels of violence or a very high tolerance for violence, which we definitely see in sports, such as contact sports like hockey and football. Rape cultures also have strict sex segregation and gender roles. So when you combine this like high levels of violence plus sex segregation and gender roles, all of this leads to a higher level of disrespect for women.
So is it different in different sports? So different in football versus cycling?
You know, no one's ever studied that. This is a highly understudied area. We do know that there are certain sports that lead to more violence off the field in general, particularly contact sports. So we're more likely to think about this when we think about a football player than a tennis player. So these kind of these pieces of a rape culture, we see how they come out in particularly in intercollegiate athletics, right? We have our men's hockey team and our women's hockey team and our men's basketball team and our women's basketball team, and everything is very segregated by sex in that way. And we know that sports in America definitely promote violence.
But what about the idea that when you've got sports like football, which are big revenue generators for colleges, that there's also this reluctance to perhaps investigate or even convict a player of sexual assault, and that is what it is about encouraging a culture of sexual assault, that they aren't punished.
Right. So that is highly problematic. And one of my mentors, who actually conducted the 1995 study, he has put out a paper and kind of outlines like these four areas for what we would consider to be a rape-prone culture, meaning if it's going to happen, this is why. And one of those pieces is institutional practices that fail to hold athletes accountable. So when we look at, are they being suspended? Are they being punished? Are they being kicked off the team? Are they being reprimanded? Or are they being, held up as star players and named as captains and they get to continue to play? That definitely makes a difference in how that fosters an environment that lets this continue to happen.
And you talked about the segregation of the genders being a contributing force. So, you know, these are gender-specific sports. In other words, the football teams aren't male and female.
Right.
So how would you address that?
So one of the things that I found in my dissertation, that when an athletic department seems to value their women at the same kind of level or rate that they value their men, at least in the women that I spoke with, they felt safer. They felt more valued. Having an athletic director show up to a women's volleyball game and not only attend the men's basketball or our football team games, it kind of promotes this culture of, you're right, we don't have female football teams yet, but if we can show that within our athletic departments that men and women are valued at the same rate, that women's lacrosse is just as important as, you know, men's baseball, I think that's moving a step in the right direction towards helping erase some of these gender roles that get fostered when we think about sex segregation.
So that would make it safer for all women, not just the female athletes.
I think so, yeah.
And so you've been studying this. Has this issue gotten worse, stayed the same? What in the last several years?
I mean, that's tough to tell. I mean, it certainly seems like it's getting worse every time you turn on the TV. But again, nobody has, except for the study that was just published last week, nobody has taken kind of this empirical look and tried to create the numbers data in the last 20 years. So it's really tough to say if it's getting worse or better or about the same. We do know that there's more money being pumped into sports than ever before, but we also know that there's more cultural awareness around sexual assault, that 20 years ago we weren't having as many programs on campuses, and we didn't have Title IX coordinators and, you know, the president creating a task force specifically for issues like this. So I'm hopeful, obviously, that we're moving in the right direction.
Christy McCray, Assistant Professor of Health and Sports Sciences at Otterbein University in Ohio. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
And we want to hear from you, especially if you are a college student or a recent grad. What has been your experience with sports and sexual misconduct? Let us know at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY or on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Hope Jaron grew up wanting to be a scientist. She had no idea she'd have to also be her own fundraiser.
For all the lip service we pay about how important science is and, you know, even the space program and getting girls into science and all this kind of stuff, we don't realize that this is a starving field.
The life of a biologist in and outside the lab, that's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, the BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Check out kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Biologist Hope Jaron has studied plants for more than two decades, but the seeds of her love of science were planted early.
I was in the lab from the time I could remember anything. My earliest memories were being under the benches and seeing the glittering glass and the machines, and it was the place where I knew I belonged. I knew that was a place where I belonged as much as anybody else.
Jaron's father was a scientist, and even though she didn't see many women in the lab, she had no doubt as to what she wanted to do. Hope Jaron has written a memoir. It's called Lab Girl. In it, she talks about her life, her constant search for funding to keep her work going, but she also blends personal stories with passages about plant biology and uses metaphor to deliver the gospel of science to casual observers of the natural world.
Science, in particular, lives within a sphere of very special words that we can only use with each other. And so the challenge for me was how to talk about these things I'd always talked about, I'd thought so much about for 20 years, and lived and breathed and stayed up all night trying to measure, etc. How would I take that other set of words, words that I could share, and map those onto that same experience and really talk to somebody else, really offer this to somebody as something they could take in. And it turned out that metaphor was a great way to do that. It turned out that some of the words that I use metaphorically, I actually mean really literally. Where is the word that's better for a tree that produces 100,000 seeds every year, and at the end of 100 years, one of those seeds will turn into another tree? Where is the word that's better than faith for that activity? not scientific term or whatever. But then again, maybe that's a more literal meaning of the word faith than anything we use it for.
So you were talking about words and ways of describing things, and you have a particularly colorful way of describing mushrooms.
Yeah.
You write, "You may think a mushroom is a fungus. This is exactly like believing that a penis is a man." That's an attention grabber. What do you mean
by
that?
It is. I think it's basic. I've always thought that. It's because, you know, a fungus is a living organism. And it goes through periods. It's born and it has a kind of childhood and it has a kind of adulthood and it has a reproductive phase. And the mushroom is something that appears for use in a different form during a reproductive phase. And it's not the entirety of the organism, but it's absolutely a part of the organism. And the function of that particular part is towards reproduction. And it's also, you know, part of the biomass or whatever. And I just think if you wanted to say it's like something else, and I'm talking to somebody that you might think more about men than you do about fungi, I just think that's one way to say one sentence and put us both on the same page.
Mm. So the mushrooms that we eat, those are actually the sex organs of the plant.
Right. You know, mushrooms are a piece of tissue that holds an awful lot of spores. Spores are the reproductive element that goes out into the world and engages in fertilization with other mushrooms. And the mushroom stalk is just a way to get that up off the ground where the spores might blow away or run around or something like that. That's how it works, more or less.
And
so
that underneath,
less like a man, but then yeah. Again.
Who knows? Well, you could stretch the metaphor. You definitely could.
Well, there you go. And it's exactly what I'm kind of enticing the reader to do.
Well, you also describe the interconnectedness between plants and us, obviously, but in particular the mushroom and the tree, because often you see mushrooms nestled underneath trees in the shade of trees. Do they do more than just take shade underneath the tree's leaves?
Yeah. So, again, mushroom is just a very specific reproductive tissue, but the most of the fungus are these kind of stringy things we call hyphae that function underground in the dark. And there's a certain number of fungi, not all fungi, that are really true and loyal friends to plants. They wrap around the roots and they function more or less like roots. It's like the plant has extra roots simply because of the fungal association, and the fungi get something out of it. They get a little bit of sugar out of the roots, and they live together and they make a go of it, and they find each other, and life is a little bit easier for both of them because of this.
So you provided a good segue for my next question, which is about your
exactly.
relationship with Bill.
Exactly.
So
exactly.
And you're a couple steps ahead of me. So Bill is, for people who haven't read the book, Bill is your longtime lab assistant, and you've worked together yeah. for
what
a long
is he?
Time.
Yeah, that's it's
I
always
guess
interesting
that's what
to
is.
See how people describe that.
Well, is he your fungi? I don't know. So,
where do the similarities start and where do they
yeah,
stop?
Yeah.
That's exactly my question to the reader. He's somebody I've been associated with. He's somebody I've dug underground with. We make each other's lives easier. We trade resources. I don't photosynthesize, and he does not rot material in order to get his nutrients. So there are differences, certainly. But we are two organisms in the world that have been in close association for an awful long time. That's true.
So yeah, he's a very unusual character as you describe him in your book. And he does not have an advanced degree, and yet he is a very accomplished scientist.
There's a lot of folks like that in science,
yeah.
Or there used to be. It's getting harder and harder for those folks to keep their jobs. Our academic model here in the United States is very much a teacher and student. And staff, you know, the people who turn the wheels and who know where the chemicals are kept and who make sure that the delivery truck doesn't bring the wrong stuff to the wrong place. You know, the people who actually build the rocket and then keep it from going off at the wrong time. You know, those are a special group of folks, and they don't want to give the talk. They don't want to be on the radio. They don't want to stand in the classroom. It's different than my job but it's absolutely the heart and soul of what we do, or it's at least a half of it. And I think there's a lot of that in science. And that was really the big impetus of the book, was to finally bring some kind of credit to this person that had made all the difference in my life. And yet nobody knew what a hero this person was, and an eccentric person, you know, that if you met on the street, you wouldn't know that this person is a hero.
Hmm. Yeah, for a period, he is homeless. He lives in a van and parks it in the university's parking lot. He showers, or I guess bathes in some fashion, in your lab, because he's making so little money as your full-time assistant. And that really lays bare what you're talking about, the lack of funding for this.
Yeah, I mean, we love this life. And when the question came along of how are we going to keep doing it, even if I can't get this grant, or if, you know, maybe things will get better. It was always, you know, how can we patch this through until things get better, until the doors start to open, until, you know, I promise, you know, I'll find a way to make this better. And I don't know if folks realize that scientists are often called on, or sometimes called on, to make those kind of sacrifices, and that there are people that love science so much they readily make them. You know, for all the lip service we pay about how important science is, and, you know, even the space program and getting girls into science and all this kind of stuff, we don't realize that this is a starving field, and that science is at a real breaking point in terms of how do we pay people to do this job that we've trained them to do.
It's interesting, because I think a lot of people think there's tons of money for science, that there's more money for science than there is for the arts, for example.
That is true. That is true. And we do have to look at, you know, I mean, you can point to a lot of noble pursuits that are underfunded in this country, and science is one of them. But I don't think there's the level of awareness that the people who want to cure disease, who want to build stronger bridges and more efficient cars and cleaner technologies, that those people are taking their materials out of dumpsters and firing some talent in order to preserve other talent and making these really hard choices. I think that I don't think we're doing a good job of translating taxpayers' values into what they support.
So right now, how is your lab doing funding-wise?
We are coming up to the end. We will run out of money officially in the fall.
So what will you do?
That's a good question. We are packing up. We are moving to Oslo, Norway. I'm moving to Norway. My father's side is from Norway. And we're going to start over for the fourth time.
You and Bill?
Yeah. Yeah, and we're hoping that we can be useful to a new system.
Do you think you get more support in Norway, more financial support?
More than nothing, which is what we're looking at here.
And what is it that you want to study?
I'm very interested in how plants respond to changes in the atmosphere at a very basic level. So plants see carbon dioxide in the atmosphere as money, so to speak. And if you give them more carbon dioxide, it's like pumping money into their economy. And just like if I dropped $1,000 into everybody's pocket in Los Angeles, they would all make different choices about what to do with that money. And plants are the same way. And so it's interesting to think about what would crop plants do with a bunch more CO2, which is a likely scenario, you know, as China and India become car-based cultures the same way we have. You know, it's not unlikely that we're going to see CO2 continue to rise.
Those aren't just curiosity questions. It seems like those are questions that we would urgently need to have answered in a warming world.
And that's how science works. You know, if I could put together the building blocks on what's important there, you know, what does it do to the roots versus the leaves, et cetera, then folks in agriculture or plant breeding, you know, could pick up on that and say, well, does that mean we need to look at yams in a different light? We've got an awful lot of hungry people relying on yams, and all these things do translate. You know, there are plenty of scientists with their heart in the right place, ready to translate knowledge into something that affects people's lives. It's just that we're all hamstrung by lack of resources.
So you have a plea at the end for the reader to help mitigate deforestation, because you say if we go on at the rate that we're on right now, there won't be any trees left in 600 years. And you basically say plant a tree in your backyard. Is that enough?
The world is a lot less green every year. You know, forests the size of France are wiped from the globe every 10 years, and that's accelerating dramatically. Every time a tree gets cut down, the world breaks a little bit. It's a lot easier to cut down a tree than it is to grow one. It takes hundreds of years and a lot of environmental luck in order to get a full-grown tree where it is. And so it's worth evaluating, is this necessary? Is it more or less harmless? Is it a great avoidable tragedy? Or is it a regrettable reality? I mean, we need to make that evaluation every time we think about cutting down a tree. I you know, of all the things that people are on the radio telling you to go do, you bring a tree into your life, and I can almost promise you it'll be a good thing that will connect you to something bigger than you are and give you meaning every day, give you something to come together with and grow with, and that's what people are really seeking in life.
Literally. And metaphorically, too. Hope Jaron is a professor of geobiology at the University of Hawaii, for now, and author of a new memoir. It's called Lab Girl. Hope, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you so much.
Coming up, Rodarte, the high fashion company formed by two Pasadena sisters. It's a favorite of fashionistas, but does it make any money? Does it have to? That's next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by nonprofit radio station KCRW. KCRW relies on member support to help keep our programming fresh and authentic. Find out how you can donate at kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Los Angeles fashion designers Kate and Laura Malivi hit it big after their New York runway debut back in 2005. Their label is called Rodarte, and they've been the toast of high fashion ever since. Rodarte clothing has appeared on the cover of Vogue. It's been worn by the First Lady, Michelle Obama, by A-list actresses. It's been in museum shows and in the movie Black Swan. And this year, the Malivi sisters are up for fashion's equivalent of Best Picture Oscar, the CFDA Women's Wear Designer of the Year. But fashion critic Robin Gavon wonders whether Rodarte should actually be eligible for that award. Welcome to the program, Robin.
Thank you for having me.
Well, before we get to that, what is it about Rodarte that makes them so beloved in the fashion world?
Well, one of the most interesting things about them is that so much of American fashion comes out of what is best described as this idea of sportswear. I mean, it's pretty simple, straightforward clothing, creative, but very much rooted in a kind of pragmatic sense of what it means to make apparel. The Rodarte designs are much more fantastical. They are just part rooted in imagination. They are often very handmade, very heavily embellished. They have a lot of handwork in them. Sometimes they are hand-painted, hand-beaded. They have been burned for aesthetic effect. So they are really meant to be something that they're meant to make people dream.
And they're art objects.
Well, you know, that's where, you know, I think you sort of wander into gray area, because they're not presented as art objects in the sense that they aren't presented as something that is meant to be a purely aesthetic statement. They're presented in the context of fashion, and fashion is a business. It's meant to be worn, it's meant to be sold, it's meant to be a commercial endeavor.
And their clothes are worn. I've seen them worn. I've seen them on the runway, as I said.
Yes,
actresses wear them.
We have seen them worn on the red carpet. We've seen them worn on the runway. We've seen them worn in magazine photo shoots and on the covers of magazines.
But they're not worn by regular people, is what you're saying.
It is very hard to find a garment by Rodarte on what we might term a regular person. if you are an anonymous person who happens to have a great deal of money, you can certainly have a Rodarte dress made to order. But if you were to go online, you would have to do quite a bit of sleuthing in order to find a Rodarte garment. It can be done, but it would not be the equivalent of going online and finding a Chanel dress.
But isn't that true with a lot of the very artistic high fashion designers? I don't know, Yamamoto. Do you actually see people wearing Yamamoto anywhere?
You do. I mean, I think, to be sure, a lot of the most rarefied designs are certainly not things that you see on every street corner. And, they're not necessarily meant to be consumed by huge numbers of people. But I think the difference is that, for most of the brands that we think of as being very creative, they have either a particularly wide aesthetic reach, meaning that their influence is felt very broadly across the fashion industry, or they have been very smart and agile in finding a way in which to build a business that supports the more creative and esoteric aspects of the brand.
And so the Malivi sisters haven't done either one of those things?
They haven't really. I mean, I want to say that I absolutely admire their creativity, and that is not at all called into question. I think that they're in a unique position because the industry has elevated them and they have, sort of embraced that elevation. But they also sort of operate in a framework that's a little bit in a vacuum. And on the one hand, while they do talk about wanting to build a business that is large and far-reaching, that's not what they're doing. That's not what they seem focused on doing. And, it's not something that really has entered their realm. And the other part of it is that you don't really see the aesthetic reach, despite the fact that the collection has been pulled into museums. It's been part of exhibitions, and it's been very regularly hailed for its great imagination. You don't see the brand having an effect on the wider fashion industry, and you don't see their sensibility trickling down.
I want to play a clip of tape of Kate Malivi from an interview she and her sister gave with Vogue from a few years ago. Mm-hmm.
Someone once said to me that, well, if I didn't know, if I didn't know what you did and you were telling me about your collection, I might think that you were an artist or that you were a filmmaker or, they were kind of giving different things. And I think that that's kind of the point for us. It's that fashion is one way to express yourself, but it's an interesting amalgamation, I think, of all the things that we're kind of interested in.
So here they are saying what you're saying, that they consider themselves artists. They're doing something different than regular fashion designers. And then when you look at someone like, let's say, Alexander McQueen, who really had a vision, he really was an artist, but he also tried to make it financially, and it pretty much killed him. So aren't they saying, look, we don't want to have to undergo all the pressures of the fashion industry in order to make our art?
I think they are, and in many ways I applaud them for that. They've decided and they have managed to carve out a niche for themselves where, they're not producing, these dozens of collections a year that some design houses produce. They produce two. And, you know, in many ways, I think that is a very sane approach to the industry. But what I think the question that, you know, the way that they operate raises is really about the fashion industry itself. And when you sort of, the industry says, this is the best that American fashion has to offer, I think that, you know, it's sort of worth exploring who these designers are so that the American consumer understands, well, what exactly is the fashion industry offering to me? And when it says this is the best, you know, is it saying that this is that means that this is something that I can go out and buy? Or are they saying that this is just the most creative idea that's coming out of the fashion industry? And what does that do when you compare a brand like Rodarte alongside a brand like The Row, which is also nominated and is another brand created by two sisters? And that brand is much more pragmatic in its approach, and you can find it, you know, in a vast number of stores. And what you see on the runway really is produced. So I think in some ways the consumer is a bit, I wouldn't say misled, but I would say is left in a bit of confusion, because Rodarte's runway and the message and the meaning of that runway is very different from the runway of another brand.
All right. Fascinating. Robin Givhan, fashion critic for The Washington Post. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
All right, and that'll do it for us today. Julie Myers will be back tomorrow with your comments. Sorry we ran out of time, but if you'd like to comment, please do Twitter at KCRW Press Play, Facebook KCRW Press Play, and you can also leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks so much for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.